The climate is changing. So are we. I'm Laura Lynch, and I host What on Earth? That's CBC's Climate Solutions podcast. Twice a week, we take you around the world to find the people who are trying to build a better future for all of us. We explore indigenous science, new technologies. We talk openly about mental health and climate anxiety. We also take your smart questions all the time. Come find What on Earth wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hi there, I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. Welcome to the Sunday Magazine podcast, featuring the stories we first brought you Sunday, April 28th on CBC Radio. College and university campuses have taken center stage in debates around the Israel-Hamas war. First up, we'll help you understand why they're driving controversy and the bigger questions it all raises about free speech and protest rights. After that, our Sunday documentary spotlights the peril and promise that artificial intelligence could spell for elections worldwide. Also today, it has been dubbed the Everything Store, but how big is too big? We'll trace how Amazon came to dominate e-commerce and beyond, and what a landmark lawsuit against it could mean for the future. And later on, you'll meet the woman who's on a mission to fill gaps in Black history education across our country. It all starts right now on the Sunday Magazine. Shockwaves from the bloody war in Gaza is causing an earthquake on campuses around the world, especially in the United States. More than 40 tent encampments protesting the war have gone up at American colleges and universities. What to do about it is causing tension. Scenes of police arresting students and some faculty protesting are playing out daily. There have been accusations of anti-Semitic intimidation against Jewish students. And higher learning has become a place of angry polarization. Alan Blinder has been reporting on this fraught moment in the history of student protest. He's a national correspondent for the New York Times who writes about education in the United States. Alan, hi.
Good morning.
There have been protests and tent encampments from Stanford in California to Columbia University in New York, campuses in between east to west, north to south. And I should say, as of yesterday, a tent encampment at Montreal's McGill University. Beyond location, though, help us understand sort of how big and widespread these pro-Palestinian student protests are.
Well, I mean, one way to look at it is not just the number of encampments that have sprung up, but it's the diversity of universities that are hosting these encampments and seeing them. It's not just, you know, Ivy League institutions in the Northeast. You may see like Ohio State University, one of the United States' big public football-heavy universities, has had one. University of Texas, the same way. So you've got not as much, you can't really pigeonhole as much, you know, the academic background, the cultural import of an institution as an easy way to say who's having an encampment versus who's not. You've also just got the swelling number of arrests in recent days. By a Times tally, we've counted more than 700 arrests in recent days. There were something on the order of about 200 yesterday across a few institutions. Northeastern and Boston, you had significant arrest last night at Washington University in St. Louis, and the list goes on and on. So there are a bunch of different ways to measure, but you're right that simply counting the number of schools involved is not really the best way to get a sense of the breadth of this.
So I referred to them as student protests. Is that a fair characterization, or who else are in these crowds?
I mean, I think the vast majority of these of the people who we can definably know who they are. They are students, they're faculty members, they're members of these university communities. There are people who are being swept up and involved in these protests who have no affiliation whatsoever to these schools. But for example, we had a protest a few days ago that we were looking at closely, and there were 28 people arrested. 20 of those people wound up being affiliated with that university. So there are clearly people, you know, who have no ties to these schools who are jumping into these protest movements. But there are also people who are saying, look, you know, there's no university tie, and that's simply not true.
Okay, I know every campus is different, and certainly when law enforcement moves into any protest, the mood changes, it's different. But how would you characterize the mood of these protests and these encampment sites?
Well, you know, there's a lot of different moods, and it depends on the institution. For example, the University of Pittsburgh, where actually commencement exercises are happening today. Pittsburgh has had an encampment in recent days, but the administration has been very hands-off with it. They, you know, the students initially chose a location. The administration said, look, we'd rather be a little bit elsewhere on this plaza. Will you move it there? They moved it. That was the end of the discussion. And they've had their encampment, and that was that. Other universities have taken a much harder line, and that's driven kind of a certain ferocity, a certain tension, you know, a certain antagonism within these protests. So it does vary school to school, but what you've seen pretty constantly is this through line of solidarity with Palestinian people. You've seen pretty consistent calls for universities to divest from Israeli-linked companies linked to settlements. There are some ideological lines. One thing that we do see, and this is fairly typical of the pro-Palestinian movement in the United States, is it attracts a lot of other types of causes to it. There are lots of people who, you know, their usual cause is, say, environmentalism. Or in Atlanta, there's this effort to oppose a law enforcement training center. So there may be a core group of students who are deeply opposed to the Israeli state. They're deeply opposed to the conflict in Gaza, the Israeli bombardment. But they're attracting other students whose, you know, day-to-day cause might not be this one.
You called the call to action as pro-Palestinian. Critics of these protests and these encampments have said they are, at least elements of the people there, are pro-Hamas. You have been to Emory's campus, which is in Atlanta, where you are, but have you seen that? Is your reporting found that?
Yeah, I mean, look, we have seen evidence of, we've heard anti-Semitic chants at some of these protests. There have been episodes of Jewish students saying they have been intimidated, harassed, frightened by some of these protests. They've been, you know, and there have been reports of physical interactions between demonstrators and others. So there are certainly episodes of activity that people have considered anti-Semitic or at least intimidating to other people, whether there's a religious element to it or not. But that does exist, yeah.
And, you know, protests at university sites and college campuses, nothing new, right? Going on for decades. During the Vietnam War, they became battlefields. Why have these protests, and maybe it's given what you just said, but why have these protests been so difficult for American university and colleges to handle?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I was talking on Friday, I guess it was, with a former chancellor of the University of Mississippi, which in 1962 had riots related to integration. I mean, you can still find the bullet holes from that riot in the administration building at Mississippi. And they've dealt with a number of protests over the years related to varied matters. And he was arguing to me, one of the challenges has been that, you know, usually when there's a protest on a campus, there's not much of a counter-protest resistance. People go off and they chant and holler and protest and do whatever, but there's no real pushback in that moment from another force. That's not the case here. You're seeing people protest in support of Palestinian rights, in opposition to Israel, but they're met with this significant pushback in that moment, in person, on social media, on the internet in general. And he argued to me that that's brought a lot more tension to this, is that people are not just speaking into into the void, if you will. There's more of a back and forth than we often see on college campuses. Someone else wrote to me yesterday and said, look, a lot of times you see protests on a campus. This was a Columbia official who, or a Columbia professor who wrote to me and said, you see protests on a campus and they're protesting against some third party distant entity that has no, you know, they may not even see the protest or notice much of it. In this case, you've got more student to student, faculty to faculty member arguing. And he thought that contributed to it as well. As, you know, when you were protesting, say, apartheid in South Africa, you know, on a campus in the United States, it might not attract much notice beyond your campus. You know, the campus newspaper might note it, for example. It's different when, you know, you're arguing and debating and going back and forth with people you see on your campus every day.
Since October 7th, since Hamas attacked Israel, we have seen all kinds of protests all over the world. What is the genesis of these student protests? I can kind of trace it back just by reading about it to April 17th at Columbia, sort of this latest round. But is that sort of what started this and what happened that then gave it all momentum?
You know, I agree with you that April 17th was really the kickoff of this round. We've seen these intense protests, not to this extent, on university campuses since October. I mean, within days of the October 7th attacks, you've had some pretty significant protest activity at Columbia. And look, the Palestinian movement has had a presence on American campuses for decades. There's a group called Students for Justice in Palestine, which has a fairly significant presence on American campuses. It's not a well-organized, you know, there's not a national Students for Justice headquarters. There's not even a national group that's incorporated, but it's this essentially loose confederation of student groups that kind of lean on each other and have, like, you know, they share some intellectual resources, maybe some, you know, tips here and there from what we understand. That group was founded a couple decades ago on the campus of the University of California, Berkeley, which itself, of course, has a very rich tradition of protest. And as decades have gone on, that group has sprouted up individual chapters around the country. And look, they have different levels of intensity. You may have, you know, a chapter of Students for Justice in Palestine that's exceptionally active at a place like a Columbia, for example, where it's actually been suspended. Or you may have a smaller chapter at a school like Miami University in Ohio, a much, you know, less high profile institution, but they're all working from the same you know, ideological strain, and that's really helped get a foothold on a lot of campuses around the country. We have not seen hard evidence that there is a single mastermind, if you will, you know, pulling the strings of these protests, but they're interconnected. Layers? Sure, there certainly are.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking to New York Times reporter Alan Blinder about the pro-Palestinian protests that are erupting on American university and college campuses, and as I mentioned, also at McGill University in Montreal now. Alan, I do want to spend some time talking about Columbia, because that seems to be, I don't know, the hotbed, or at least where the attention has been focused. Why has this university in particular become such a hotspot?
So on April 17th, it was, I guess, two Wednesdays ago at this point, Columbia University's president and the co-chairs of the Board of Trustees and the head of an anti-Semitism group on campus, they went to Capitol Hill in Washington to testify before Congress about the handling of anti-Semitism on campus at Columbia. And what was interesting about that hearing is that in the hours beforehand, students began to build this encampment at Columbia. So the president of Columbia is on Capitol Hill. She's facing enormous pressure from lawmakers in Washington to take a harder line, and she agrees to do so, essentially. She tells Congress that she's not going to tolerate unauthorized protests at Columbia. She's not going to tolerate anti-Semitism at Columbia. And then she leaves the hearing, and she's got this, you know, burgeoning encampment on her campus. And the next day, the New York Police Department moves in. So it's interesting. In that moment, she may have satisfied some of her skeptics or critics in Washington, but the decision to bring in the police really infuriated the campus at Columbia. I mean, this is a university that in 1968 had the police brought in to handle some other protests. And that really scarred the university. That's still a very much a fixture in Columbia's history. So her decision to bring in the police a few weeks ago really intensified the passions at Columbia that were already intense enough to have drawn the attention of Congress. The students rebuilt the encampment. Columbia has allowed it to remain ever since. There are these constant rumors that they're going to send the police in. There was a rumor that the university and public officials rebutted. They were going to send in the National Guard even to take it apart. But Columbia has really been the center of this. And as you've seen, you've seen a couple weeks now almost of this encampment. You've seen a lot of high-profile visitors, a lot of high-profile rhetoric around it. And so Columbia, you could argue, is the emotional and intellectual center of this particular round of protests.
So far, the president of Columbia, Manoush Shafiq, has been able to keep her job. On Friday, the university senate passed a resolution calling for an investigation into how she has been leading her university to respond to these protests. We've seen other university presidents being forced out or resigning, but under great pressure after they testified at committee in Washington. Why have university presidents been arguably so bad at handling this?
Well, you know, I was talking with a few presidents and former presidents and chancellors in the last few days, and they were saying, look, the hard thing is you've got these enormous pressures coming from all different constituencies. You're making decisions really at the drop of a hat. And let me tell you, in academia, that's not really the norm. Academia, they like to have committees and discussions and they're listening sessions. And you're asking, in a lot of cases, presidents to make decisions minute to minute, hour to hour. Another thing that's a challenge here, and we wrote about this in today's paper, is the challenge of what do you do about bringing in outside police forces? Because as one former university chancellor told me, the second you bring in an outside police force is the second a university leader loses control of the situation. So you've got, university presidents who are seen generally as having this far-reaching, all-encompassing power, especially on private campuses, private institutions. And it's being tested. It's being tested by students who are just wagging their finger and saying, we're not going to follow whatever, decrees you send down about encampment policies and whatnot. You've got politicians demanding this approach or that approach. You've got alumni who have their own views of it. And it just becomes this fast-moving stew, if you will. And it's something that university presidents just in their day-to-day don't really deal with anything like this, to be honest with you. So it's trial by fire.
So some universities, police have showed up, I think at least at one, maybe two. The National Guard has been called in, which has a difficult relationship with protests in the past. What other consequences, and I know there's a great diversity of universities here, but what other consequences are those who are protesting facing?
If you wind up arrested, you're generally getting, like this was the case at Yale University this past week. The students who were arrested received a summons for trespassing. So we're talking very, very low prosecution. No one is being sent to prison for months or years or decades for this kind of protest activity. You're seeing students be suspended. You're seeing occasionally banishments of students from campus if there's an exacerbating circumstance, but you've got, for the most part, occasional student misconduct proceedings is essentially what we're seeing.
I want to ask you about professors, because some of them have been out there, and I want to ask about a video that's gone pretty viral. It happened at Emory in Atlanta, where you are, and there have been protests there, cracked down by police last week. And it was a scene of, you'll be familiar with it, the police arresting an economics professor, which has gone viral. What happened there? What has happened to her? And what's the situation at Emory now?
Well, I mean, she's out of jail. She did spend some time in jail this past week awaiting a hearing on bond. But look, she was, by her account, she wasn't a protester. She came out of her office to investigate this melee that was beginning to unfold on the campus at Emory. So what happened at Emory, which is a private university of probably 16,000, 17,000 students in Atlanta, it's got you know, everything from undergraduate programs to law and medicine. It's a comprehensive university. They about 7:30, 7:45 on Thursday morning, some protesters came onto campus and they began to erect an encampment on the quad at Emory, which is really the core of campus. It's green, it's serene, it's surrounded by, you know, these gorgeous buildings, and it's really the heart of campus life. I mean, it's where commencement generally is at Emory. They built this encampment. Emory was not one of those schools that was prepared to let this encampment linger. Some schools, as I said earlier, allowed these encampments to last and really go undisturbed. That was not Emory's philosophy. Within an hour, Emory had called in the police, and the Georgia State Patrol and the Atlanta Police Department and the Emory Police Department were all involved. And within a few hours of the encampment surfacing, you had police officers and state troopers dismantling the encampment, arresting protesters. We saw faculty members who had come out to observe this being wrestled to the ground. We saw one protester being hit with a stunning device. We saw pepper balls being deployed. It was a fairly remarkable scene for a place that had been calm several hours before. In the end, you had 28 people arrested. 20 of them were tied to Emory in some form or fashion.
You mentioned the politics of all this. This is becoming a highly charged political issue for politicians of all stripes. There was a student protest leader at Columbia who said before the protest began that, quote, Zionists don't deserve to live. He apologized. The university has banned him from campus. The White House condemned his remark. President Joe Biden has been condemning anti-Semitism on campus. We saw the House leader, Mike Johnson, Republican, calling for the National Guard to be deployed in Columbia. How much more difficult does this become, given that it's becoming increasingly politicized?
It's a challenge. I mean, look, you've got university presidents who are deeply worried, especially at public institutions, about how politicians view their universities. I mean, I was talking to one university president, a former university president, who was talking about a time he had dealt with a protest on his campus, and he was getting calls constantly from not only the state's sitting U.S. senators, but the state's former U.S. senators at the time. And the governor was, you know, pressuring him to do one thing or the other. And look, we're in an election year in the United States, as you all well know. There's a lot of political posturing that can take place in any election year. This is a topic that is resonating, at least Republicans think it's resonating with their voters. It feeds into their sense of, you know, Joe Biden has allowed this lawless America to take hold. You know, we'll see in the coming months how much voters agree with that depiction. But for now, Republicans are really going to town on this idea that universities, these laboratories of higher learning that they often associate with liberalism, so to speak, you know, they're happy to depict them as these bastions of anarchy. Whether that's actually, you know, true on the ground, it's not always the case, rarely the case, but, you know, they see it as good politics at this point, and that is there's not a lot of unity that you're seeing among university officials and public officials on what these protests are and how to deal with them.
So the post-secondary year is almost over, like some commencement ceremonies have been canceled or postponed at some of these universities. Some universities and colleges have gone online, but most students have wrapped up their year, so their academic year. Do you think these protests are going to wind down with the winding down of the academic session?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what administrators are hoping for. Look, when we were seeing protests throughout the fall semester before, you know, the winter holidays, I cannot tell you how many administrators told me, we've just got to get to Christmas break, just got to get to winter break. And that's very much the vibe I'm picking up on from administrators now, of just got to get to summer break, because you've got students, many of whom will have internships, summer jobs, what have you. You know, a lot of schools, their dorms close for the summer, so housing becomes a different thing. There's no guarantee that the end of the academic year will mean an end to these protests. I think they do expect, and I think it's probably fair to expect, you'll see some at least some waiting. There won't be as much activity, just as students, you know, they've got other plans for the summer. It's possible that they will last and they will linger and they will endure. But I think for a lot of administrators, they're really just hoping to get through the next couple weeks, and then they'll see what the geopolitical landscape looks like as students return, you know, more fully in August and September.
Just briefly before I let you go, what's the most important lesson both universities and student protesters have learned to this point?
Oh, I think, frankly, the lessons they're learning are still very much in question. I'm not even sure they agree on the lessons they've learned at this point. I think you've got some university presidents who will probably tell you, look, you got to take a hard line on this stuff. You've got some other university presidents like Columbia saying a couple days ago that they thought that calling in the NYPD again would maybe inflame the situation at this point. I think student protesters would tell you the lesson here is that you can't suppress, you know, a protest movement and extinguish it surely by police force. You know, whether that will remain true in the coming weeks, anyone's guess.
We will see how this all continues to play out. I appreciate so much you joining us this morning. Thanks, Alan.
My pleasure.
Alan Blinder is a national correspondent for the New York Times who writes about education in the United States. You're listening to the Sunday Magazine on CBC Radio, SiriusXM 169, and on the CBC Listen app. I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. As we've been discussing here on the Sunday Magazine over the past few months, 2024 marks the world's biggest election year in history. It is also the first time artificial intelligence is poised to have a significant impact in our elections. Many experts worry that AI's potential to quickly and easily sow disinformation could threaten democracy around the world as we know it. But beyond the potential for harm, others also see new democratic possibilities in the technology. Craig Dessen from CBC's Audio Doc Unit has been looking into the powers and perils of AI in elections. Here he is with our Sunday documentary. This is called AI at the Ballot Box.
I wake up and sincerely, it feels like every single day I'm protecting democracy.
That's Michael Moore. He's the Chief Information Security Officer for the Arizona's Secretary of State office. Michael's job is to imagine everything that could go wrong in an election and have a plan. A job he finds more troubling with the advent of generative artificial intelligence, especially as the United States faces another deeply divisive election in November.
I'm not going to answer the question.
Why
because,
would you answer that
because
question?
Because the question is, the question.
And there's a lot of bad you can do, right? Voice cloning has basically been perfected. So with a very small sample of your voice, I can have imperceptible level of quality in voice cloning. Video content, it's at the point now where it's really, really good. If you have someone's consent, it's almost perfect. But we're going to see videos of President Biden, former President Trump, doing, saying great things, terrible things.
So he's trying to organize a response from different government agencies.
We're working with law enforcement. We're working with our Department of Homeland Security, the National Guard, CISA. Like, we're connecting with all of our partners to make sure that we're aware of these types of attacks and doing literally every single thing we can against every single one of them.
Then, a few months ago, in a hotel ballroom in Tucson, Arizona, Michael gathered a group of government and law enforcement officials for a day of presentations about AI and deepfakes.
We had a really big focus on the weaponization of generative AI, and we created deepfakes with the consent, but without the cooperation of our Secretary of State, Adrian Fontes, meaning he said, yes, you can do it. Here's the type of content I want you to make, but I won't help you train the AI. So we used our expert, went and took publicly available videos of the secretary and used a cloned sample of his voice. The cloned sample of his voice, completely perfect.
On day one, the video was presented as an address from the Secretary of State, Adrian Fontes, who was in the room when it played. After the video finished, Fontes addressed the group.
And then the real secretary said, hey, that's a deepfake. I didn't do any of that.
Michael had made his point about how good deepfakes can be. The group of officials were then shown some of the latest AI tools so they can understand how easy it is.
During the exercise, took two of the attendees, pulled them out of the room, took 30 seconds of recorded video of them with just a standard laptop camera, and created videos of them saying and doing things like speaking perfect fluent German, which the volunteer does not speak.
By doing this, he hopes the officials will be better prepared. He wants them to be able to spot and respond to any deepfakes that might arise during the November election.
So we want to give them the worst possible election days that they could have, but in a safe environment where they can fail, learn, and improve their process when they go home.
There's really nothing new in making fake audio or video of politicians. What's new is you can do it in minutes.
We recently saw the whole robocall of Biden, and I've compared it to, it's like if an attacker discovered this space-age weapon, like a laser rifle, but then they used it to rob a convenience store. That's the level of competence they used this. So if I were given this tool and I was funded by a nation state or just really wanted to disrupt this democracy, what's the worst things I could do?
In early January, a guy named Paul Carpenter says he got a call from someone asking him to do a job, generate an AI voice.
Can you make the voice? I was like, yeah, that takes me, you know, 20 minutes, 30 minutes to make the voice. I just need you to send me the ad copy.
Carpenter is a magician living in Houston, Texas. He also has had an occasional side hustle making deepfakes. You might not have heard of him, but you've heard of the work he says he made.
What a bunch of malarkey.
An AI-generated Joe Biden.
This coming Tuesday is the New Hampshire presidential preference primary.
The content was used to make robocalls to thousands of New Hampshire voters leading up to the Democratic primary there. The fake Biden was falsely telling them he didn't want them to bother voting in the primary.
It's important that you save your vote for the November election. Again, your vote makes a difference in November, not this Tuesday.
And that recording made international news.
AI-generated content campaign. The Biden campaign.
People were shocked. And Paul says he was as surprised as anyone. Paul says he's the man, well, magician behind the voice. He told me he was hired by Steve Kramer, a veteran political operative who was working for Dean Phillips on a long-shot primary challenge to Biden. Paul showed me screenshots of text messages and cash transfers he says were sent between him and Kramer. Now, Paul insists he had no idea the voice he made would be released to the public like this.
It was just a gig for me. I was getting paid $150.
Neither Steve Kramer nor the Dean Phillips campaign responded to my request for comment. After the story of the robocall broke, Paul says Kramer, the guy who hired him to make the voice, texted, telling him to keep what they'd done on the down low.
And that text message said, shush. I wrote, get the f*** out of here, as an acronym. Like, get the f*** out of here. What are you doing? And I immediately called him. And I'm like, bro, what are you doing, dude? And this is when he's like, oh, I can't get caught. I spoofed the number. Nobody will know it's me. Just delete all the emails that you and I had together and just forget about this ever happening.
Forgetting this ever happened was never going to be an option. The New Hampshire Attorney General has launched an investigation.
So I immediately freak out, thinking I'm going to go to prison for the rest of my life.
The investigation is still ongoing, and the New Hampshire Attorney General's office won't comment on whether Paul is part of that investigation.
The lasting damage of it is not so much what was in the call, it's the fact that next time people are not sure what, well, you know, they don't even know what AI can do. It's almost like, so you could show me anything now, and if I'm not, I don't know what AI can do, therefore it could be fake. So suddenly you've lost all credibility in everything, actually.
That's Neil Johnson, a professor at George Washington University in D.C., who studies the internet. He believes the big impact of AI on our elections is going to be less one big deepfake, but thousands of little events whose impact will be subtle and insidious.
We always hear the media story about the one big thing, but for me, it's the thousands and thousands, and I don't know how to count them now because we have trouble detecting them, of little messages that can be put in everywhere I see it as a kind of low-level pollution of the whole system.
He thinks not all these deepfakes will be convincing. But again, the images seed doubt. Like, for example, the AI photo of the Pope in a giant white puffer jacket. I'm sure you saw it. It was everywhere online last year.
My fear, again, is not the Pope in the puffer jacket, because that already looks strange, but funny, kind of, but strange. It's more the case of I can produce, or anyone could produce, low-level text that looks indistinguishable when looked at very quickly, and that could be done at, you know, mass-produced. And so it's not one big thing that's going to be the impact.
There is a lot of worry and fear, but some people see a reason to hope that AI can bring new ideas to our democratic process. And it's already happening. Andrew Gray is a lawyer who does work in the not-for-profit sector. Last summer, he ran as a self-declared AI candidate in a UK by-election in a rural locale called Selby and Ainsty, about an hour and a half drive east of Manchester. He decided to go big, leaning heavily into the AI for his platform.
I knew that people were going to hate me because AI was so newfangled and weird, and I was in a very traditional area. And I could just sense that when my leaflets hit the doorstep, most people would be reviled by, repulsed even, what by my campaign. I knew I wasn't going to get liked. But I also knew that people are so wise, and that's exactly what the AI tool helped me spit out, was a lot of sensible, prudent policies.
He had a bold new idea for what a member of parliament should be. This is how he pitched himself to voters on the BBC.
The people should set the priorities. The MP should do as they're told. Technology now allows us to collate wisdom, so let's start there.
Andrew says he can do this with a free online tool called Polis. It's powered by machine learning to poll citizens, collect policy ideas, and find consensus.
And my friend came across Polis. I'd never heard of it. I thought, wowzers, how have I not come across this tool as a political nerd?
Magically, he says, because he could see the potential for how machine learning could help draw out commonalities between voters that perhaps might not otherwise be noticed. Andrew discovered Polis during the pandemic.
There was a tech friend of mine and I, and we were brainstorming about politics. If everything's going on to Zoom, if everybody's making banking transfers, even older people are making banking transfers online, and the banks in our towns are closing down, surely politics is going to move rapidly in a tech-orientated way.
And with AI as his guide, he thought he had a good shot.
So I did think I could win, and actually during the election campaign, the bookies had me in third place.
He truly believes this AI tool could reach beyond the divided online mobs that are shaping our politics now. That's the dream. But I still wanted to understand how exactly this is supposed to work.
Let me see here. MPs should be making policies to reduce the complexity in our private...
Basically, you have a web page where you get rapid-fire answers to short questions with agree, disagree, or pass. But it's not like a regular poll where voters are being asked a set of specific questions. Voters can riff by adding their own questions too, which gives it a late-night poli-sci student vibe to it.
Discussion. Religion and politics should not mix.
It felt a bit like TikTok, with the mix of swiping, decision-making, and not knowing what was about to happen. And behind the scenes, these responses are being ranked and categorized, using machine learning to find ideas that people can embrace.
If you interact with me via this AI tool, I'm going to get to know your politics perhaps better than even you would know them. And I can find all these amazing consensus points and produce a manifesto that you're going to love. I adore Polis because it's the antithesis of the debates that go on social media. So Polis is looking for consensus. It doesn't pour petrol onto disputes. and create a bin fire like what happens on Twitter or X or Facebook. It's the opposite of that. So it's looking for agreement. And when you talk to people just in a pub, in a cafe, you realize that most people agree on so many issues. Yet if you then go on social media, you'll think that there's actually these culture wars that are going on, which aren't really happening. They're just in some extremes of social media. So Polis is the antidote to that. It's the tool of our time. It's a cure.
AI did not propel him to victory like he hoped.
I got very few votes, got 99 votes.
About 36,000 votes were cast. Evidence suggests voters weren't keen on an AI candidate.
Some of the emails I would get from potential voters was like this. Hello, Mr. Gray. I have seen your leaflet come through my door. I have a question. Are you real? Next email from the same person. What do you think about the housing development in my area? To which eventually I reply, well, I don't know anything about the housing developments in your area, I'll be frank about it, but I would like to poll the people in your area to find out. And then they would get angry with me for asking them their views on their housing estate. And I was trying to explain, why would I know?
Elizabeth Dubois is a communications and technology associate professor at the University of Ottawa. She's been studying how AI is being used right now in Canada's electoral system.
You could create a generative AI tool that has a database of your campaign materials, and it can do the first draft of a speech for you.
Of course, this won't thrill speechwriters. She also believes AI can do some of the massive amounts of work that go into every single race, that it can open the door to less established people.
We can also imagine that these kinds of tools can speed up processes that help campaigns identify what comm strategy to use in one context or another, to allow smaller civil society groups or smaller, maybe independent candidates to do things that larger campaigns are doing.
We're already seeing examples of this. There are tech companies offering AI-based tools that can help candidates sift through voter data and even call voters. The type of work candidates depend on political parties for. AI is taking root in our elections in ways that many find disturbing and others find useful. But perhaps the most crucial question when it comes to elections is how much voters will know any of this is going on. Abhishek Gupta is the principal researcher at the Montreal AI Ethics Institute.
And then, you know, when you think about, okay, well, you know, to what extent, you know, the public, that is the subject, the target of these systems, understands what the capabilities and the limitations of these AI systems are.
He thinks we need to educate people about what this technology will mean for voters.
The point that I'm trying to make here is, how do we foster AI literacy, right? How do we educate the public about what role AI is playing in campaigns and to maybe reinforce trust and credibility?
Michael Moore, the guy who helps protect election integrity in Arizona, agrees.
We have to ask people to do a due diligence of when they see something, you need to determine whether or not it's truthful. Where did it come from? Who made it? Why did they make it? What is it evoking you to think, feel, and do? So we can't, it used to be like, you know, you see a video and you had a pretty good confidence, like, oh, that's real. Or you hear somebody's voice, oh, that's definitely them, because that's definitely their voice. But now you can't.
Regaining trust in the political system may be difficult for some. It's interesting to note that after the fallout from the Biden video, the U.S. Federal Communication Commission ruled AI-generated robocalls are illegal. As for Paul Carpenter, he decided to make another fake AI video of Biden. Not for a robocall, but to make a point.
After all of this blew up, made a video of Biden with his lips moving on my Facebook page, and it says, "This is the end of media as we know it. Next question."
The point being, you can't stop fakes. So voters, get ready for a new kind of election.
That documentary was produced by Craig Dessen from CBC's Audio Doc Unit with support from Joan Weber.
I'm Nala Ayed, host of Ideas. In this age of clickbait and online shouting, Ideas is a meeting ground for people who want to deepen their understanding of the world. Join me as we crack open a concept to see how it plays out over place and time and how it matters today. From the rise of authoritarianism to the history of cult movies, no idea is off limits. Ideas is on the CBC Listen app or wherever you find your podcasts.
If you bought anything online recently, there's a good chance you shopped at one particular website. Amazon is the world's largest online marketplace with more than 300 million annual users. Last year alone, it raked in $30 billion US in profit. But the tech giant has long faced scrutiny over how it reached this huge level of success. And it came to a head last fall when the U.S. Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, and 17 states sued Amazon, accusing it of illegally protecting a monopoly over online retail. Amazon has denied those allegations. Dana Mattioli is the Wall Street Journal's dedicated Amazon reporter, and her new book paints the big picture of how Amazon got so darn big and the price paid. Her book is called The Everything War: Amazon's Ruthless Quest to Own the World and Remake Corporate Power. Hey, Dana, good morning. Thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
I don't know if this will be striking to everyone, but I think it will be to a lot of people that the Wall Street Journal has a dedicated reporter, a full-time reporter in you to cover one singular company. What does that say to you about Amazon's reach and influence that a job like that is necessary?
Not only do we have me, we have another full-time reporter on Amazon. That's how big it is. It is like covering 12 publicly traded companies in one. And it's kind of funny in 2024 to think about it, how it started, because it started as this against all odds online bookstore when most people didn't even have computers in their homes. And that was clearly the canary in the coal mine. And I'm happy to give you the full picture of their scope these days, because it's really staggering.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because, you know, Americans use Amazon, everyone almost in the world does. A lot of Canadians use it as well. It accounts for roughly 41.5% of retail e-commerce sales in our country. This is according to the research company eMarketer. And so people who say, you know, the other 58.5% are saying, like, look, I don't shop on Amazon. I got nothing to do with Amazon, but you don't need to shop on Amazon to be touched by it. So give us a sense of how pervasive Amazon is in everyone's daily lives.
Yeah. I mean, this company is unavoidable from so many perspectives. You know, Jeff Bezos wanted it to become a daily habit. He didn't just want people to shop on it once a month for paper towels or books. He wanted it ingrained in consumers' lifestyles, and he's truly achieved that. He even told one of my sources, "Your margin is my opportunity." And that's how they've approached industry. So if you look at it today, it's this giant octopus of a conglomerate with so many tentacles. And it has 40% of online retail in the US. It's the world's biggest cloud computing company, one of the biggest digital advertisers in the world, the top parcel carrier in many countries. It makes the top selling voice activated speaker and streaming devices. It's the biggest seller of ebooks with 82% market share. And then it's a grocery store, a podcast maker, a film studio, and even a healthcare giant. In the middle of reporting out this book, they actually bought my doctor's office.
Really?
Yeah.
Like Amazon owns doctor's offices in the United States?
Yeah. They bought One Medical, which is where I've been going for years, which means all of my labs, my tests, they now belong to Amazon.
Oh, wow. Okay. So it's trying to be a behemoth in so many fields and industries.
That's right. And they've succeeded to an extent that I don't think anyone else has. It's kind of like the Standard Oil octopus when you think about it, where it's got all these tentacles in disparate places. And what's interesting is when they expand into new places, Wall Street makes a very vocal bet. If Amazon files a patent in a new industry or hires a big executive from a different company that they're maybe not in that industry yet, you often see the stock prices of all the existing companies in the space just fall. There's a sell-off, right? Because people are betting that Amazon's going to win.
You interviewed hundreds of people for your book, former Amazon execs, competitors, small business owners, and you were charting how Amazon got to where we are in 2024. Let's go back to its humble beginnings. Jeff Bezos started Amazon out of his home garage in Washington State. This is 1994, so 30 years ago. Sold only books. But this was the early days of the internet when e-commerce was barely a thing yet. So it was pretty revolutionary even at that time. But what potential did Bezos see in the future of online shopping back in 94?
He did books as this test item because they were small. There's too many titles to fit in one bookstore, so you could have unlimited selection online. And that was really just the litmus test to test out the whole idea of online commerce. What's really interesting about Amazon.com is he got the idea while he was working in New York for a hedge fund called D.E. Shaw. His boss was really bullish on the internet back when most people weren't even using it. 3% of people had even been online at that point in the U.S. And his boss said, hey, can you research selling things on the internet? And that's where Jeff really came up with the idea for Amazon.com.
And so after its early success in those early days, Amazon expands well beyond books. It becomes this one-stop shop that we know today. It becomes that in part, Dana, because of the millions of smaller retailers that sell all their stuff on the site. So I shop at Amazon from time to time. It's often a third-party retailer, but I buy it through Amazon. So if I was a small business, what might my relationship with Amazon look like? Like, what do I owe them, both financially and perhaps otherwise, in order to be able to sell my wares there?
Yeah, when you speak to the sellers, it's truly this double-edged sword. They have to be on Amazon because there's so many shoppers there. There's 200 million Prime members worldwide. They can't just forsake that. Even though so many of them complain about the relationship, Amazon has been able to raise their fees on sellers because they know that sellers need to be there. So over the last decade, for instance, the average take that Amazon gets of each dollar of revenue from a third-party seller went from 19% to 45%.
Wow.
And that's made it really hard for these sellers to make a living. And some of them have had to raise their prices on their goods in order to offset it. And that's where the FTC comes into play. They're saying Amazon is causing higher prices for consumers.
Yeah, let's talk about that FTC lawsuit that you just mentioned. I mentioned in our introduction. So it accuses Amazon of illegally protecting a monopoly over online retail by squeezing merchants and favoring its own services. The company, Amazon itself, denies all this. But can you break down more specifically what that looks like according to this lawsuit?
Yes. So the FTC lawsuit is alleging two things. They're saying that Amazon knows that sellers need to be on Amazon because of how big it is. And with that in mind, they're able to levy all sorts of fees on the sellers. And in some ways, being a seller on Amazon.com, the platforms become pay to play. So you need to buy ads to even show up in the search results, and Amazon gets a fee. You need to have Amazon Logistics in order to be a part of Prime, Amazon gets a fee. And it's gone up to that 45% number. In turn, those sellers have just become, it's become a lot harder for them to make profits. So they've raised the prices for consumers. But the really interesting part of the FTC lawsuit is they say that Amazon has so much power in e-commerce. And because they sold for so long, they contractually made their sellers sign an agreement that Amazon would have the lowest price of their goods, even if they sold elsewhere, that if they had to offset all the fees on Amazon and raise their prices, they also had to raise their prices on other websites. Hmm. So the FTC is saying that Amazon has raised prices throughout e-commerce.
And for me as a consumer, that means I'm paying more for a product that I could get at many places because of the deal that Amazon has struck with a small business I want to buy the product from.
Exactly. And I have examples of that in the book, in practice, where that has happened. There's one seller that I spoke to. He took over his dad's family business. He wanted to digitize it to get more of an audience. He signs it up for Amazon.com. And they make $10 million a year in revenue on Amazon.com, which sounds great. But after all, you know, he pays $1.5 million a year in advertising there. He pays for shipping. He pays for all these other things. And the overhead, it turns into $30,000 in profits at the end of the year.
Hmm. Let's talk about Jeff Bezos, one of the richest people on the planet. He owns a lot of things, including Amazon. You describe him as having a quote-unquote killer instinct and the atmosphere that he has built at the company. Tell me more about Jeff Bezos' killer instinct, the influence that's had on Amazon's culture and how that sort of shaped the way it all approaches business.
Yeah, I mean, there's no denying that Bezos is brilliant and he was a visionary, but personality-wise, he could be very Machiavellian. There are anecdotes in the book that almost paint a cruel portrait of him, where he could be petty or not nice. There's one scene in the book where Toys R Us has a new CEO, and Bezos calls the CEO up on the first week of his job and says, "Hey, how does it feel to work with poor performers?" Just out of nowhere. And the guy's sort of taken aback. And he tells his early employees that were sort of missionaries that wanted to democratize reading that they didn't have that killer instinct, to your point. And I think as it relates to the book, some of the more shocking behaviors in the book are driven by this culture that he's created. It's a very aggressive company. It's cutthroat. It could be Machiavellian. And it creates this pressure cooker of an environment where employees sometimes do whatever they can to stay ahead and keep their jobs.
Hmm. So, you know, for a lot of people, consumers out there, they say, look, I like Amazon because I get my stuff delivered to my house. It comes very quickly. I get pretty good, you know, prices. There's a lot of options available. So some might look at its success and see a good business strategy. Where is the line between good strategy and bad practice?
Well, I would say, you know, people definitely use Amazon. They like their Prime. But there have been allegations from regulators around the world that this company has too much power. It really started in Europe, where they started raising the alarm bells, and the US was a bit late to policing its own digital giants. There's now been a reckoning on that. But when you look at what these countries have been looking into, they're saying that Amazon's dominance has an effect on the broader economy, on the broader industry. And even in reporting out this book, I could tell you, like, if you just look at the retail sector and the amount of jobs lost over the last decade at the hands of Amazon is pretty staggering. When I speak to venture capitalists, they are careful on not backing companies that might go head to head with Amazon because it's like a foregone conclusion that Amazon's going to win, right? So there's other effects on innovation, on job creation and the like.
What are the job losses over the last decade?
There's a few different reports on this. The American Booksellers Association found that in 2018 alone, there was a net loss of 700,000 retail jobs in the U.S. And this next stat is like actually pretty telling to me. In the U.S., between 2001 and 2017, department stores lost 18 times as many jobs than coal mining.
Hmm.
And I could tell you, I spoke to a lot of the mall owners for this book, department store CEOs, and they do point at Amazon for a lot of this.
If you're just joining us on this Sunday, I'm Pia Chattopadhyay, and I'm speaking with Dana Mattioli, reporter with the Wall Street Journal, who covers Amazon. Dana has a new book out about how the company has shaped online retail and the big questions it all raises about competition and consumerism. So, Dana, you mentioned Standard Oil. I want to talk about the comparison that you made between Amazon and Standard Oil. Of course, that is the American oil empire that was run by J.D. Rockefeller around the turn of the 20th century. The U.S. government successfully sued that company over its monopoly over the industry. It led it to being broken up. So draw the parallel here for me.
Yeah. So it's actually really interesting. The head of the FTC, Lena Khan, who has brought this lawsuit against Amazon, when she first started researching the company back when she was in law school, she drew the parallel between Bezos and Rockefeller. And she was doing this research for this anti-monopoly think tank called Open Markets, and she kept running into Amazon. And it just seemed strange to her that Amazon was considered this darling while Standard Oil had been broken up for being a monopoly. And she saw some similarities in the way they competed. Both were spying on competitors. They engaged in predatory pricing. They would bully their partners. And it was just striking to her that no one was questioning Amazon's power.
The Standard Oil case, just to understand this a bit more, was brought under antitrust law, basically another word for competition law. The case against Amazon revolves around how such laws are interpreted. So how has Amazon changed that conversation around antitrust laws in the U.S.?
So Amazon and big tech in general has sort of benefited from this change in the interpretation of antitrust laws in the 1970s and 80s. The laws were first derived in the Gilded Age, and they were enforced initially to protect competition and small businesses and the like. But then there was a period in time in the 60s and 70s where some critics thought that it was overreaching, that it wasn't protecting competition, it was inhibiting competition, that it was going too far, and the courts were siding too much with David versus Goliath. So there was this school that came about called the Chicago School of Antitrust Theory, and they started saying, you know, we're doing this all wrong. We should judge competition based on prices for consumers and efficiencies. And the courts accepted that. And for the last 40 years, that's how things have changed. And it's allowed companies like Amazon, but also Google, Facebook, where they either have free products or, you know, in Amazon's early days, they were a very low price retailer. So if you had free or low prices, you could kind of skate by, even if you were doing other things that might have been enforced in prior decades.
Yeah, there's that ongoing case by the U.S. Justice Department accusing Google of illegally abusing its power over online search to throttle competition. The FTC has filed that suit against Meta, accusing of bullying rivals to illegally squash competition. So both companies have denied the allegations. But I'm wondering, Dana, with, you know, sort of the tech environment, what does this picture say about the larger conversation happening around the regulation of big tech right now? And why haven't we seen more government oversight around Amazon until now?
It's just really fascinating. For a very long time, the U.S. was late to police its own giants. And these companies were really held up as examples of innovation and job creation. They were like very, very embraced by like the Obama administration, you know? And there were some rallying cries abroad to better police these giants that were dismissed in the U.S. And more recently, I think, you know, the 2016 election was a big turning point where people saw misinformation on digital platforms and started to question big tech. I think Lina Khan's paper about Amazon in 2017 also started making people question big tech and Amazon specifically. And now there's this new movement in the U.S. that's really gaining momentum, led by Lina Khan and John Cantor, who's the head of the DOJ here, the Department of Justice. Even some Republicans are aligned with this mission, and they're saying, you know, we need to rein these giants in. And there have been a lot of lawsuits against big tech in the recent years.
So right now, there is this public conversation, and policymakers are grappling with the question of how big is too big for a corporation. You have reported that Amazon's current president and CEO, Andy Jassy, is asking a different question. He is not asking how big is too big. He's asking, is it big enough? And he recently told his deputies that Amazon could become a $10 trillion U.S. company in the next decade. It would be the biggest in history. So what could the future of Amazon look like? Where else could we see it appear in our lives if it continues down the path its leadership wants it to?
Yeah, I think it's very telling that in the midst of all this scrutiny, they're saying, let's, you know, five times our size is if we could get to, right? And there are areas that they are definitely focused on. One of them is artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. It's obviously a huge area for a lot of companies right now, and Amazon's really well positioned, especially with their Amazon Web Services business, to really capitalize on that. They've made investments in other generative AI companies. Healthcare is definitely an area of focus. It's one of the biggest sources of GDP. They've really just started scratching the surface there. And they are, you know, imminently going to be launching satellites in their Kuiper business to compete with Starlink. So there's a lot of different areas that they're just starting to get into that they're dedicating a lot of resources. So the $10 trillion figure, while it sounds crazy, it could be achievable.
And so for me, sitting behind my computer, flicking on my Prime and watching it, or I don't know, listening to an ebook on Audible, all those things that I do, and many Canadians do. What do you want me to think about? I mean, hopefully I'll just lose myself in a book or in a show, but what do you want me to think about in terms of Amazon when I'm using their products?
You know, there are a few companies in business history that have had as much of an impact on life, on the economy, on job creation as Amazon, but they've really done a good job remaining this black box. They are secretive by design. And I hope that when people read this book, it really lifts the veil on their business practices, how they have their thumb on the scale in a lot of ways, what that means for partners, competitors. And, you know, there's parts of the book that I think will be really revealing, like how they use their M&A apparatus, how they use their venture capital fund and meet with all of these unsuspecting entrepreneurs and founders who then cry foul and say that Amazon stole their ideas. They opened up their kimono and stole the ideas. And I think this will shed a lot of light on how Amazon works.
Din, appreciate your work on this, and thank you for pulling back the curtain on this, as you have written about and for many years now, this really important company to all of our lives. Thanks a lot, eh?
Thank you for having me.
Dana Mattioli reports on Amazon for The Wall Street Journal. Her new book is called The Everything War. By the way, we reached out to Amazon for comment. The company sent us a statement reading, in part, quote, "The facts show Amazon has made shopping easier and more convenient for customers, spurred lower prices, enabled millions of successful small businesses, and significantly increased competition in retail." In response to some specific claims in Dana's reporting, the company told us the following. Amazon selling fees are 15% or less in most product categories. Advertising is an optional service. Sellers can manage logistics themselves and still be part of Prime through its seller-fulfilled Prime program. And the suggestion that Amazon steals entrepreneurs' ideas is an inaccurate characterization. And quote, "gaining insight to copy products is in no way part of this team's mandate." You're listening to The Sunday Magazine, and I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. Black history is Canadian history, so says Afua Cooper. It's part of why the Halifax-based historian has made the development of Black studies core to her 30-plus year career. From advising on racial justice in the workplace to teaching courses spanning Caribbean culture and Black feminism and writing books and poetry about Black life. Her latest step in that mission is A Black People's History of Canada. This is an ambitious endeavor that aims to craft free learning resources for elementary and secondary schools across our country. The federal government granted just over $1 million to fund the project over 3 years, which was overseen by Afua at Dalhousie University. That's where she works. The period has just wrapped, and today Afua Cooper is with me to talk about the result. Good morning to you.
Hi, Pia.
Let's start with that notion of Black history is Canadian history. Seems kind of obvious when I say it, but explain it more for us.
Well, what I mean by that, I would also take it further to say Black history is global history. But what I mean by Black history is Canadian history, and you hear other people saying that too, not only me, is that Canadian history has to be conceptualized and to be taught in as many of its parts as possible. And Black history is part of this wider frame that we call Canadian history. And in order to understand Canadian history, then we have to understand all its parts. Basically, that's what it means.
And from what I'm hearing from you, I'm guessing there has been an absence of it being part of Canadian history in our education systems over time. But give me a sense of how well you think Black history has been reflected in education.
Not well at all, from kindergarten to undergraduate courses at universities. So from the very earliest to the very latest, even right up to a PhD. Things are changing now, obviously. But for the longest while, you know, I have two sets of children that went through the school system here in Canada. And it has always been a struggle. Sometimes there is a moment in Black History Month, February, where the school does something, but more often than that, nothing happens. And I have to be going in the schools, whether it's a social studies teacher or a history teacher, and say, hey, what's going on? And because I'm a historian too, having children, I'm like, well, let me see your curriculum. What are you doing? And usually it's nothing. And so then you go on to university, you look at the university curriculum, whether, you know, in arts and social sciences, where I am, the humanities, and often there's very little with respect to Black history, especially Black Canadian history. So it's really not a very progressive picture.
You know, I know that in February, as you say, during Black History Month, my kids come home from elementary school and tell me something really fascinating about Black history in Canada. But the rest of the year, it's not something they're really learning, at least not to the extent that they do in February. How does that absence of history affect Canadians, particularly like kids in the classroom?
it affects people's their self-esteem. You don't see yourself reflected in the curriculum. We know about the power of image, or, you know, photographs, illustrations, seeing yourselves in a film, seeing people who look like you in a film, seeing people who look like you in the textbook, perhaps more importantly, in the textbooks that children consume and that children are exposed to on a daily basis throughout the school year. And so not seeing yourselves, then you begin to think, well, you don't matter. You don't count. It's only the typically the white imagery that's in the books and the photographs of white children that matter. So it affects people's self-esteem. Again, I go back to my own children, and I also have been involved in parents groups. So I've dealt with other children, other students in primary school, high school. And you see this kind of tuning out. If their experiences are not reflected in the curriculum. So we talk about imagery, but we also look at content in terms of, say, what's in the science curriculum? What's in the history curriculum? How is your culture? How is your heritage reflected throughout the curricula? And if it's not, then you're going to begin to think that you don't matter, you don't count. It's only one set of knowledge that's important, and that's a Eurocentric set of knowledge, you know, white people's history, white studies. And that's what children across this country for centuries have consumed. And it's time we put a stop to that. That's why we say Black history is Canadian history. And when we look at all the various other histories, we want those to be reflected too in the curriculum.
And that is where your project comes in. It is called A Black People's History of Canada. It's ambitious. It spans, and I say ambitious, it spans a huge period from the early 1600s, obviously before Canada as a country existed, right up to the oral histories of people in our Black diasporas today. How did you and your team then approach creating resources that encompass hundreds of years of history and people?
Yeah, absolutely. You're right. It is ambitious. We wanted to look at Black history in Canada across space and time. But the thing is, there are tons of resources. You know, I've done a PhD in Black Canadian history. I've done a master's degree. I've taught it for all these years. So I know what's in the archives. I know what's out there. And what's out there is rich and, you know, vast. So it is for us now to harness that and to put that out there. So we draw on the strengths and on the expertise of folks. So some of the people who are involved in this project are people who have been doing Black history for a very long time. Like, in total, there are about 13 researchers on the project. If you're doing a project this vast, you need a lot of people power. I wish we had more, but what we have, the pool of researchers and research assistants that we have, is wonderful. So we look at topics like Black aesthetics, Black businesses, barbering, hairdressing, slavery, the Black press, so many different topics, and some of the more traditional ones that we teach in school, like the Black Loyalists, the War of 1812, the Underground Railroad, women's history, and so on.
As you say, you know, a lot of Black history that we learn as Canadians is either based on the American experience, or it has to do with the Canadian experience of slavery. Even at a very limited level do we learn that. So when we learn those things, it's a limited focus. You say, look, we're also talking about all these other things. You made it central to also surface beauty in your project. Yeah. So how do you go about striking that balance?
Well, it comes out of deep thought. So we want to show the oppression. We want to look at the multiple threads that I believe when we weave together constitute, Black history, these multiple threads. So you look at the oppression, but you also look at the resistance, and you look at the multi-layered dimensions of any Black community. What were Black people doing across time and space? After slavery was abolished and Black people began to build communities, it wasn't we were not just responding to white racism. Of course, that was a feature of everyday life. But Black people built communities. They were in search of and created joy, leisure, beauty. So, you know, we one of our researchers who sadly passed away recently, Wade Path and Christina Soto, did this research on Black beauty contests. That was just like totally amazing and beautiful and wild in 1928 in St. Catharines. Black people were into aesthetics, hairstyle, dress, fashion, and I wanted to showcase some of that. That it wasn't always, you know, about Black communities being mobbed and destroyed, as in the Birchtown riot in the 1780s. It's about creating a multidimensional nature, not hiding the oppression and the slavery and the anti-Black racism, but realizing that that's not the only part of us, of our history, that we wanted to highlight. So it's really striking that balance. And also, using what the archives is offering and also going beyond that, because you talked about at the beginning of this discussion about the oral stories, about the oral interviews. Sometimes you have to go to the elders, you know, and say, okay, your experience is not reflected in the archives or in the history books. There are silences about your experience in the archives. Tell us about your life. And so we are presently doing that. If you look on our website, you'll see a series of webinars. So I want folks to look at those, because those are more contemporary. And right now I'm doing a series of interviews with elders that also will be posted on the website. And we also do the daily blogs and social media posts, you know, little tidbits that I think are as important as the larger articles.
This is The Sunday Magazine. I'm Pia Chattopadhyay, and I'm speaking with historian Afua Cooper, who's spearheading the educational project called A Black People's History of Canada. Afua, as I said, you're an academic. This is not just academic, though, for you. It's very personal. You have taught Black history at various Canadian universities over the years, and you have described facing resistance along that journey. What has that looked like on campuses for you?
Well, it came from the university itself, the institution itself, saying, I remember there was an institution I was at. There was a long discussion about, you know, instituting Black history, having a permanent course on Black history. And then when it came to time for that, they just backed down. They're like, oh, whether it was funding or whatever it is, they just backed down. That's one example. Another example would be, this person signed up for the course, paid his money, and in the third week of my teaching, this person got up and began to abuse me and hurling racial slurs and was very threatening and, you know, the N-word used liberally. Fortunately, the other students really got up, saw what was happening, got up, surrounded me, someone called security. And for the rest of that semester, there was an undercover police, plainclothes policeman in my class.
Oh, wow.
Because there was a real threat that someone did not like what I was teaching. And you also get students, too, who you think they're real students or they're interested, and then they begin to abuse you. So I always say teaching Black history is dangerous, whether the institution doesn't want it, or from the general public. And there are times when I would not put, like, say, the title of my project on my door, for example, my office door. It just remains blank because you don't know who is passing through at nights. And I know not everyone is in favor of Black history being taught and happening. So those are some of the resistance, the pushback, back that I have, I have experience. And also in graduate school, I think I have to say this, going to graduate school, doing my PhD, there was not a lot of support for that. I was told that Black Canadian history isn't really that important. I should choose another topic. And so it was just through my own, how do I put it, my own confidence and my fighting spirit that I was able to succeed and get that PhD, because it wasn't easy.
Hmm. You are also a parent. What have your kids' experiences been like going through school? As you said at the beginning of our conversation, look, things are changing and improving somewhat, maybe not fast enough, but they are changing. And how have your kids' own experiences sort of inspired your efforts around this work?
Yes, I remember sometimes photocopying pages from my own publications, putting it in an envelope, giving it to my kids and said, give this to your teacher. There were Black people here in 1750 or whatever, because I had one of my daughters told me her teacher said Black people started coming to Canada in 1955 with the domestic scheme. Good for that teacher. She did have some kind of historical knowledge. And I remember there's a book that I co-authored called The Underground Railroad, Next Stop, Toronto. Just photocopying pages, giving it to the kid, my kid, and sometimes going in the schools and becoming very proactive. I would give talks to the schools, to the whole school, the auditorium where my children attended. But imagine the amount, the burden now that places on me. So I'm a parent, but I also know how to be a teacher parent to educate my children's school. It's too much for Black people. And then there's a resistance from the school itself, from the school board itself, from the Ministry of Education itself to Black history. So as you can imagine, my joy really when this current Ontario Ministry of Education said come September 25, they're going to be instituting Black history in grades 7, 8, and 10. But we want to see it from kindergarten right to grade 12.
Mm. As you say, Ontario's government is announcing this change, and it's only in those three grades. But Ontario is the first province to explicitly mandate Black history lessons in its public school curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
I hear you say, like, we'd like it in all the grades, but how big of a step is this? It honestly kind of surprised me that we don't have this in our curriculums across the country. So when they made that announcement, I was like, and this sort of speaks to my own ignorance of not seeing the absence of it. But how big of a deal is this?
It is a big deal. It is a big deal. But I am optimistically cautious because I'm saying, okay, well, to do this, you have to pay attention to teachers' college. Teachers are being trained in teachers' college. So Black history has to be mandated in teachers' college, because if you want teachers to come in the classroom and teach, then they have to have that knowledge. But, I don't think the minister would make this big announcement without doing due diligence. I hope that this is happening at the teachers' college level. I hope that teachers who are already in the system and do not know much about Black people will be able to take a retraining course or some kind of course. I hope the ministry and the appropriate school boards will confer with the community, because there are many, many people and stakeholder groups in the community that you have to talk to. I wonder what will the nature of the curriculum be like? What's going to be taught? Are you just going to begin from 1955, or are you going to begin from 1604? But it is a good step. It's a step in the right direction.
As you say, part of this is about what educators are educated in. There have been lots of efforts recently around enhancing many elements of our history in schools. Education around Indigenous peoples, the history of the Holocaust. If I'm an educator, that's a lot to balance, right? How do I do all of this without giving any of them short shrift? How do I learn about all of these things? What are some of your solutions there?
Well, I think this is where you bring in the educational experts. There are tons of those people around. We do have the resources. It's not as if you're going to teach Black history, your whole curriculum from September 4th to June 30th is going to be on Black History. You have units, right? So that's one way, you know, from September 4th to November 4th, it's one unit, or that could be even two units. So there are people around who have done this, who know how to do this. That's not difficult. I went to school in Jamaica, and I thought the Ministry of Education there, I went to primary school and high school, I thought they were very, very creative. I learned to, by the time I got to Canada, I knew about Canada. I could walk. I knew about the Prairie Provinces, the wheat export, the Three Oceans. We were taught that in geography.
Yes, and in Canadian schools, they learn about European history all the time. Yeah,
easy. So, I mean, you know, people are creative. We have the resources. We have the expert. It's not a big deal.
But the challenge might be, you know, it's one thing to create the material as you have, but the challenge might be is to convince different schools in different provinces to adopt it, right? To get it into those classrooms, which really is the goal here. So how do you plan to do that?
Well, that has to come from the provincial government and the provincial Ministry of Education. If we say this is a democratic society and we want everyone to be integrated, one way to integrate people is through civics, is through history, is through social studies. And when we started this conversation, I was talking about seeing yourselves reflected in the learning material and what that does to, you know, you as an individual. So much research has been done about the impact of cultural learnings and cultural understandings on kids' progress. The research is out there. People are integrated into the educational system by foregrounding their heritage and culture. It's like a no-brainer. Kids do better. That's shown across the board all over the world. And so if we take that seriously, and if we want to be, for education to be really this tool of democracy, then we will do this.
And if at least these school-age kids, you know, they eventually go on to be the yous and me's of the world. So broadly speaking, you know, if and when we bake this kind of education into our school systems at an early age, what does that mean for the society they grow up to inhabit?
I think it would mean that people, kids who growing up to become adults and leaders and teachers and doctors and, you know, engage in all kinds of professions, will be more empathetic. It would also mean a lessening of racism. I think really one of the values and one of the goals of education is to eliminate racism or diminish racism. Because if you learn about people, if you learn about your neighbors, if you learn about actually that what you're eating is produced by your neighbor's culture, then that opens your heart. I hope you become more empathetic. So education for empathy, education for understanding, and education for love. At the end of the day, education for love, so we can hold each other in some kind of esteem.
Afu, you know, there's so many people and time periods and histories within your project, but I'd like us to end with some music. And there's one particular artist that you highlight in your project. Her name was Portia White. So can you just tell us who she was and why her story matters to Canada?
Absolutely. So Portia White was an award-winning, classically trained Black woman contralto opera singer from Nova Scotia. She was born in 1911, and she graced the stages of the world singing opera. Black woman singing opera at a time of Jim Crow. And she would sing at some of the, she would sing rather at some of these stages and concert halls when she couldn't go enter the restaurant, the neighboring restaurants, because she was black and black people were not allowed in those places. So, you know, imagine the double consciousness that she had to possess to go through the world and be successful and be such a wonderful role model, hugely talented woman. So I did a seven or eight minute video of her. People can go to the website, blackpeopleshistory.ca, and learn more about Portia White.
Afu, I know this has been a project of love, but also of necessity and a lot of hard work, and appreciate you making it for all of us to learn more about our history. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Afua Cooper is a historian and professor at Dalhousie University in Halifax and the principal investigator of its Black People's History of Canada project. And that is it for this week on the Sunday Magazine. Our producers are Levi Garber, Brianna Goss, Andrea Huang, Adam Killick, Pete Mitten, and Aronde Williams. Our senior producer is Howard Goldenthal. Our executive producer is Brian Colton. I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. Thank you so very much for lending us your ear. Till next Sunday.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.